So the topic of my talk is photonic packet switching for broadband networks, and as you heard, if you miss anything, you'll be able to review this by looking at this on the web page of the local chapter, and I understand there'll be the video signal will be digitized, and it will be possible to look at least part of this talk from your own personal computer. What I'd like to do is talk about photonic switching and its application to broadband networks, and highlight to you some of the advantages and, I guess, challenges ahead in the area of photonic packet switching. So what I'd like to do is give a quick overview of some of the key issues in packet switching and photonics, and talk about some of the key technical issues that need to be addressed if photonics is to find a role in future packet switching. What I'd like to do then is focus in on some of the key components and subsystems that will be required to make a future photonic packet switch, and then illustrate some of these concepts with some examples from the literature, some proposals and demonstrations of photonic packet switching that have been demonstrated and proposed recently. And I'd like to conclude with an outlook, a picture of what I see as the outlook for photonic packet switching. But before I move on to photonic packet switching, perhaps I should just say a few words about ATM. I think many of you in the audience will be familiar with ATM, but some of you may not. Thank you. Some of you may not be. So this slide gives a very simple view of what ATM is about. And some of these concepts will then continue into my talk on photonic packet switching. ATM stands for asynchronous transfer mode, not automatic teller machine in this particular context, and it has to do with a technique for multiplexing and switching in telecommunication systems. Essentially, with packet switching, data from a source of data, for example, a workstation, is formed into small packets for transmission through the network. And each of these packets has two components, an address header and a payload. The address header contains the information, contains the address on the packet, and the payload contains the information. The address header determines where that information is to be sent, and the payload is the information itself. In a sense, packet switching is parallel, if you like, to the mail system. When you send a letter to someone, you write the payload on the piece of paper, you fold it and you put it in an envelope, and you write the address on the front of the envelope. The letter then finds its way through the mail system and is sorted along the way, and finally comes out at the other end in the mailbox of the person it's addressed to. And along the way, it's sorted and separated from other letters. In a sense, the ATM is an electronic or photonic version of the same type of system. So in a system where there's a number of sources, workstations, for example, with data being put into various packets, these packets can be multiplexed and sent down a transmission path with packets multiplexed in the time domain, and then switches in the system can be used to separate and sort these packets into outgoing lines for delivery of the packets to the destinations. Now, in electronics, packet switching has become a very important field, and ATM has now emerged as a standard in electronic switching, and is going to be very important in the future. It's important already. There are certainly very rapid developments in electronic ATM switching, and bit rates as high as 2.4 gigabits are now available, and even higher bit rates are coming. And it is possible to conceive that electronic packet switches will be achievable with throughputs in the order of 1 terabit per second. Now, I say this because it's important when we look at photonic packet switching, as I'm going to do, to keep electronic packet switching in mind, because electronic packet switching is developing and already has very high capacity, and it's important that we put the photonic packet switching work that I'll be talking about in the context of the world of electronic packet switching. So how could photonics be used in packet switching? And this picture gives a view of how one might conceive photonic packet switching being used. And the concept here is that there is an all optical network. This yellow cloud represents some network, and I'll be saying a bit more about what's in that cloud in a minute, which contains all optical components that transmit and switch data through the network in an all-optical sense. And connected to this all-optical packet switch network are a series of nodes and interfaces. And for example, here there is an electronic ATM switch which is connected to a number of users, and this interfaces to the all-optical network. And the concept would be that the data originating in one of these users would be switched through a local ATM switch and concentrated via an interface into photonic packet form, and then transmitted through this all-optical switch to some other destination, perhaps this interface, through another ATM switch to another user. The idea here being that the all-optical switch, the all-optical network, in a sense, aggregates the data from these users around the side of the network and provides a much higher capacity than would be capable of being achieved with an ATM switch of the conventional form. And this takes advantage of the characteristics of the all-optical network. You could imagine that the ATM local area networks and databases and perhaps paid TV or video on demand centers connected to this kind of network. So what I'd like to do now is talk about how you might construct this yellow cloud, this all-optical packet switch network. And this is a simplified diagram of what you might find in such a network. The idea is that there are a number of all-optical nodes 1, 2, and 3 shown here, interconnected by an optical path, and these thick black lines represent optical paths, probably optical fiber. And just to illustrate the point that I made before about how data in packet switch networks is packetized, data is put into a packet with a payload preceded by a header, and I've shown here a red header indicating that this particular packet is destined for this output. So the idea is that this node looks at this packet, determines that the header from the header that the packet needs to be routed to this output, routes the packet to this output, and it travels to node 2, and then again the packet is routed through this node to this output depending on the information in the header. I'm also showing here that in general for an all-optical network, the wavelength might in fact be changed as the packet passes through the node, so it might be wavelength lambda 1 here, lambda 2, and lambda 3 here. Similarly, another packet at a different wavelength, lambda 4, with a different information in the address header is routed through the network to somewhere else. What I'd like to do now is concentrate on what might go inside one of these nodes in this photonic packet switch network. I guess before I do that, though, I'd just like to say a few words about why one would consider using photonic packet switching over the alternative of electronic packet switching. And I think perhaps the big attraction for many people to this area of photonic switching and photonic packet switching is the potential offered by the so-called transparency of photonic components. The concept here is that data in an optical form can pass transparently through a photonic component without any limitation on the data rate, because there is no optical to electrical or electrical to optical conversion. In other words, the so-called electronic bottleneck that you might run up against if you're using electronic switching in a network is avoided. And this electronic bottleneck certainly becomes a problem at bit rates above perhaps 10 gigabits per second, although I should hasten to add that electronics is continually getting faster, and it is now possible to get electronic components operating as high as 40 gigabits per second. But somewhere in the 10 to 40 gigabit per second regime, one strikes the electronic bottleneck and it's harder to go to high bit rates, whereas optically transparent components could in principle overcome this. Another advantage is that one can obtain multiple channels via WDM and again eliminate the bottleneck with electronics. Another attractive feature of photonic packet switching is that it is potentially compatible with the fiber transmission medium. And so, as I said before, you can use multi-wavelength systems and interface the fiber directly with an all-optical network and eliminate optical to electrical and electrical to optical converters. One point that I should make here, and I'll make this a number of times during my talk, is the fact that photonic packet switching does offer certain advantages, but it may turn out that one doesn't necessarily use the ATM standard in photonic packet switching, and so non-ATM systems might find might be important in photonic packet switching. So what would go inside one of those nodes? And this is what I'm going to concentrate on now, how one might build a photonic packet switch. How could you make one of those nodes that would take incoming photonic packets and route them to outputs depending on the information in the address header? This is a basic block diagram that shows the sorts of components you need. These are inputs, a number of input fibers and a number of output fibers at the output. The core, of course, is the switch fabric, some kind of photonic switch which takes inputs and connects inputs to the output so the packets are routed through. But in addition to the switch fabric, one needs a number of other functions. There is a controller which needs to look at incoming packets, make decisions on the basis of the information in the address header, and then set up the switch fabric so that the packets are appropriately passed through. In addition, there's a need for buffers and synchronization, probably at the inputs, or possibly at the outputs, and also, as I'll mention later, a need for header replacement. And all of these components have to work in unison under the control of the controller. Now, I've shown here an optical path with a thick black line indicating that the path through the switch is all optical, and there is no optical to electrical or electrical to optical conversion through the switch. Similarly, the controller looks at the optical input. But I'd like to make the point, and I'll make this point a number of times, I guess, during the talk, that while everything here is photonic or optical, it may make sense for the controller to be electronic. In fact, there are good reasons to use an electronic controller in a photonic packet switch, and for this reason I'm showing electrical paths from the controller to the various components in the switch. So what are the main issues that need to be addressed if photonic packet switching is to become a reality? And I need to stress the fact, as you'll discover from this talk, if you haven't already realised, that photonic packet switching is not a reality yet, and there are a number of issues and challenges to be faced before photonic packet switching can really be assured of a place in future telecommunication networks. First is the question of optical and electronic processing and control, that controller I showed on the previous view graph. How do you design that? There's a very important question of contention resolution and buffering, and I'll come back to that very shortly. There's a question of synchronization of incoming packets, the switch fabric, switch fabric do you select? There's a question of trading off between centralized and distributed architectures. Header replacement's another important issue that I'll mention briefly lately. Timing recovery. Signal level control and thresholding is another important issue. Most of the components we have access to now, most photonic components, are in fact analog components. And what we're doing is using analog components like amplifiers, switches and so on, to perform digital functions. And we don't really have the equivalent of optical AND gates and OR gates and regenerators like we do in electronics. And so often we're fighting to use analog components to do digital processing. And this often results in difficulties in keeping levels appropriately under control. So signal level and control is quite an important one. And another issue that I won't have time to talk about today, but a very interesting and important one, is the question of packet decompression and compression. Can you take packets and compress them into a very short time frame to increase the bit rate and increase the capacity? I won't have time to talk about all of these issues today, but what I'm going to concentrate here is I'm going to say a few words about electronic processing, contention resolution and buffering, which is perhaps the key issue. I'll briefly mention switch fabrics, and I'm going to say something about header replacement. This is the only slide I have which has any mathematics, so if anyone is worried about mathematics, you can relax. This is the only mathematics you'll see. But what I'm trying to do here is just highlight a couple of the key limitations that one has to pay attention to when considering how a photonic packet switch works. And what I'm showing here is two incoming packets into the switch. Here's the switch and here's the controller. And I'm characterizing these packets by a few key parameters. B header is the bit rate of the data in the header. B payload is the bit rate of the data in the payload. And T packet is the length of the packet in time. Notice that I've B header and B packet can in fact be different. In the ATM standard, they're the same. It turns out for photonic packet switching, you may want to have the bit rate in the header lower than the payload, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The idea is now that this controller needs to look at the header to make a decision, and so the bit rate that the controller has to be able to read is the bit rate in the header. And the controller is characterized by two main parameters: T process, the processing time, the time it takes for the controller to make a decision, and the F clock, the clock frequency required to clock the header into the controller. Note that the controller doesn't care about the payload. The payload's of no interest to the controller. The payload just passes straight through the switch. These two equations basically determine the limitations on the controller. The processing time, T process, has to be length than the length, the T packet, the length of the packet, less than or equal to it. So the idea is that the controller has to make a decision once every packet. So long as it can do it within that one packet time, that's okay, because you can always put a delay here that simply delays the packet while the controller is making its mind up. The only other constraint is that the clock frequency has to be sufficiently high to clock in the bit rate of the header. So in fact, if the bit rate of the header is sufficiently slow, you can always use electronics here to read the header and clock the header in. And if this time is sufficiently large, there's going to be sufficient time for an electronic controller to make up its mind. So some researchers have been talking about using optics in the controller. I personally feel that might not be necessary, and it may be best in this type of switch to use electronics for what electronics is good for, that is decision making and control, and keep the optics in the optical path, where optics has a real unique advantage, that is optical transparency. I'd like to move now to this key question of contention resolution. This is an issue for all packet switches, electronic or photonic. The idea here is that there is a packet switch with a number of incoming lines and a number of outgoing lines, and this packet here arrives first, and the address header is labeled N here to indicate that this packet is destined for this output, and the green is the payload. So the packet switch sees this packet, it makes a decision, and routes that packet through to the appropriate output. But just after this packet, another packet arrives with a different payload destined for the same output. If this packet was switched through the switch at the same time as the first packet, they would both arrive at the same output, overlapping in time. There would be a collision between the two packets, or a contention, and data would be lost, and this would be disastrous from the point of view of the data. And this is, as I said, is a key issue in any packet switch, and this contention must be resolved if data is not to be lost. Well, there are two ways of going about it. One approach is fairly simplistic. It's known as deflection routing, where the second packet, if the output line is occupied, is simply misrouted to another output. So in this case, it was meant to go to output N, but it was routed to output M. It's on the wrong output, but at least it hasn't been lost. Now, in some cases, this might be a problem, but if there are sufficient other switches further down the line, it's possible that it would eventually find its way to its ultimate destination. If the Canadian postal system is anything like the Australian postal system, sometimes this happens in the mail system too. A letter gets lost on the way, but eventually finds its way to the destination, sometimes weeks late. In the packet switching network, then, a packet that gets misrouted might eventually find its way to its destination, although it might be late, and if you require the packets to arrive in a certain order, this could be a problem. Another alternative, then, is to use, and perhaps a better solution, is to use contention resolution by buffering, where the second packet, instead of being routed through, is stored inside the packet switch in some sort of buffer or memory, and once the first packet has been passed through, then the second packet is routed through after it in time sequence, but not on top of the first packet, and therefore avoiding the collision. So this is the best solution, because packet orders are retained, but it becomes now a major issue, because what's required in this packet switch is an optical memory or an optical buffer. And there are many ways of going about buffering. This particular diagram could in fact apply either to a photonic packet switch or an electronic packet switch. You could put buffers or memories at the input so that packets are buffered and then fed to the switch in an appropriate order to avoid contention, or you can have buffers at the output to avoid buffering contentions there, or in fact input or output, or in fact in some cases it's possible to in a sense deflection route the packet to an output and then buffer it back to the input again and try again. That's another approach that could be used. Now, these are well-known methods in electronic packet switching, and in electronics, it's quite easy because you go down to the local electronic store and you can buy memory chips, but it's not quite so easy in photonics. There is no readily available, commercially available, certainly, a photonic random access memory. One has to think about how you can form an optical buffer for use in a photonic packet switch. And here are three possible architectures you might consider. This is a so-called loop memory. This is a directional coupler or a cross-point switch, so incoming packets could pass either straight through or be looped around a delay line, perhaps be boosted with an amplifier, and maybe this could be done a number of times before passing out of the switch. This would basically delay the packet and store it for some time. Another approach is the so-called staggering approach, where incoming packets go via an optical switch into an array of delays, and then are combined again in another switch. So an incoming packet could be delayed for a programmed time before being combined at the output. Another approach is the so-called traveling wave memory, where incoming packets are routed through a series of delays of different length and through a series of cross-point switches. So an incoming packet could be passed straight through, for example, or it could go through one or two delays before going to the output. And again, by programming those delays, you could determine the amount of storage. Now, this question of buffering really is, I think, the key issue for photonic packet switching, so I'd like to spend a little more time talking about buffer memory requirements because and techniques for making buffers, because if anyone can think of a better way of buffering optical data, then it's really going to be very important for photonic packet switching, and maybe someone in the audience might come up with some better idea for how to buffer optical data. What's needed for an optical buffer for a photonic packet switch is something which is easy to control. Optically transparent, we need to retain this idea of optical transparency, no optical to electrical or electrical to optical conversions. It needs to have good capacity, and that's a real challenge, as well as being simple, having an output power which is independent of storage time, essentially be a digital memory, low noise, and the possibility of first-in, first-out capability so that the order of packets is maintained. I'd like to say a few more words about some of the characteristics of very simple memories. This is the simplest possible buffer memory, which just has a switch or splitter or a combiner or switch. You only need one switch in the system, and a delay equal to the cell period or packet length. And the idea here is that an input, the packet can either be switched straight through or stored by one cell period. But it has a buffer capacity of only one cell and a maximum buffering time of only one cell, so its capabilities are very limited. The other one that I mentioned earlier is the loop memory with a cross point and an optical amplifier and a delay around the loop again equal to the cell period. This again has a small component count, but it does require an amplifier in the loop. And the reason why you need an amplifier is because every time the signal passes through the cross point, there is a loss. And if you don't know in advance how many times you're going to loop the packet around, you don't know how much loss there will be. And you can't. So it's not possible to cascade a single amplifier with this system. So what you need is an amplifier in the loop to give a loop gain of exactly one around that loop. Again, the capacity is only one cell, and another problem here is that because there's an amplifier, the maximum buffering time is limited by noise accumulation, because as packets pass around this loop, every time they pass through the amplifier, the noise is increased. This particular memory has the advantage that it has random access, in the sense that you don't have to know in advance how long you want to store the data for, and once the data is in the loop, you can withdraw it any multiple of TC after you inject the packet into the loop. And another potential advantage is that using wavelength division multiplexing, it should be possible to expand the capacity of this loop memory by storing a number of packets simultaneously. It's possible to build multiple cell memories by cascading a number of single cell memories of the kind I showed, by cascading them like this in series, where you then increase the buffer capacity to n times the number of N cells with N memories in cascade, and you also can increase the buffering time by this method as well, but the number of components increases. And another approach is to use a parallel structure with a switch at the input, a switch at the output, and a series of cell memories connected in parallel. And this is something like the parallel structure I showed a little earlier. And in this case, again, the maximum buffer capacity is M times the capacity of a single cell where there are M cells in the memory. The reason why I'm showing you the series and parallel connected cells is that I want to give you a feel for the size of a memory that you might need for a photonic packet switch. And I think when I show you the size that you'll need for a real photonic packet switch, it'll come home to you, if it hasn't already, how this question of buffering is really a key issue. And to illustrate this, I'm going to use some data from a paper published by some workers in Fujitsu working on multi-cell buffer memories. And this is a simulation of a buffer memories for a photonic packet switch showing the number of components you need. And what these people did was they simulated a four input to single output buffer. The idea is that there are four streams of incoming packets all combined via this buffer memory to a single output. And the idea is that the packets are arriving randomly on these four inputs with cross-on statistics, and the buffers store the packets with sufficient capacity so that no matter how the packets arrive, they can be properly ordered in the output without collisions. This gamma of 0.2 is the so-called work rate, which means that incoming packets on this line occupy 20% of the total time. And so if there are four channels with 20% work rate, then after proper buffering, the output line has a work rate of 80%. So the challenge is determining how many components you need here, how big those buffers need to be, to make sure that for randomly arriving packets, you can always combine them to a single output with minimum number of packet collisions. Well, these people did the simulations both for the parallel type switch that I talked about before and the serial switch, and demonstrated just how many components you need. This shows the cell loss rate as a function of the buffering time. The cell loss rate is the, if you like, the probability that two cells will collide. It's very similar in a sense to the error rate in a transmission system. And the target cell loss rate that they were working for was 10 to the minus 10. 10 to the minus 9 is also sometimes used as a target cell loss rate. I'm not going to talk much about the difference between the parallel structure and the serial structure here, but what happens is that they both asymptote to this line here, and what it shows is that for a target cell loss rate of 10 to the minus 10, you need for a parallel structure something like 22 cells in parallel, and for the serial structure something like 50 cells in series. And if each one of those contains a simple loop memory or a simple memory with a delay line and a couple of switches, you're very soon talking about 20 or maybe 50 optical components for the single buffer memory. And you can see it becoming very large. Well, I'd like now, having given you a bit of background, move to some examples of some proposals and demonstrations that have been described in the literature for photonic packet switch. This was one from a group in CSELT in 1993. This is a switch that these people have demonstrated, been working on for some years, and in fact their work has gone a bit beyond what's shown here, but this slide I think very neatly shows the basic concept. For the moment, I'd like you to ignore everything to the left of my pen here and concentrate on the components to the right. These are the incoming lines. This is a fiber loop memory, which forms buffering. So there's buffering at each input of the switch with an optical amplifier in the loop and a frequency selective filter. And this little component here, labeled FC, is a frequency converter. So each incoming packet is converted in optical frequency to another optical frequency, may be stored in the loop, and then goes to a space frequency switching subsystem which has tunable filters and frequency converters again, and this then, given the frequency determined by the first frequency converter and this filter, routes the packet to the appropriate output. So the key functions of packet buffering and routing are performed by these two components. And again, in this situation, there is a controller using electronics. This is a simple demonstration of packet switching from our group at the from our laboratory at the University of Melbourne, also from 1993, showing how one could build this type of packet switch with available components. This demonstration photonic packet switch has two inputs and two outputs, and an electronic controller using intercoupled logic, lithium niobate crosspoint switches for the routing components, and semiconductor optical amplifiers in the loop memories. So incoming packets pass through a 10 dB splitter to an optical receiver which looks at the address header only, and the electronic controller makes decisions on the basis of the address headers. The packets are then routed either in through memories and circulated a sufficient number of times, and through the switching element to the appropriate output. The switching elements and the optical amplifiers are controlled by the electronic controller, and the reason why we need to control the semiconductor optical amplifiers is that each of these amplifiers has sufficient gain to overcome losses in this loop. And so the loop gain in this loop here is set to be equal to 1, and most of you will recognize this as being a laser. An optical feedback system that has a loop gain of 1 will eventually generate light. The noise will build up to a point where stimulated emission will occur. So it's necessary to switch the semiconductor optical amplifier off after the memory has been used, after each use, to avoid the memory turning into a laser. The electronic controllers then determine the states of the switches and the condition of the optical amplifiers. This switch works very effectively. The main limitation is that we have only one memory at each input, and compared with the simulation I showed a little earlier, you'll recognize that this is probably too small for 10 to the minus 9 packet loss rate. In fact, with this packet switch, it was necessary to reduce the work rates at the two inputs to about 10% in order to get the packet loss rate down to the 10 to the minus 9 rate. So if we wanted to use this packet switch with work rates of the order of 80%, then the packet loss rate would be very large and it would be necessary to use more memories. So again, the key limitation here is the size of the memories. This is a packet switch which was demonstrated by a group from Alcatel as part of the European RACE program. Again, has a very similar structure, with incoming packets being detected by directional couplers and an electronic controller. These yellow rectangles with the arrows through them are again frequency converters. So on the basis of the information in the address header, the frequency converter converts the frequency of the packet for routing before it's routed through the switch. These are a series of delay lines of differing length, and these form the optical buffers. And essentially what happens is that the packets are routed through these splitters and a series of semiconductor optical amplifier gates to these delay lines, and then pass through a space switch to the output. So buffering is performed in this part of the switch, and routing of the switch is function is performed here. In this case, there are 16 inputs and 16 outputs. To give you an idea of the complexity, this was one of the earlier demonstrations from that group with four inputs and four outputs, four wavelength converters at the input, and for this type of switch you need quite a number of gates, and you can see these little red rectangles are semiconductor optical amplifiers. There are in fact 16 semiconductor optical amplifier gates required in this switch. So the number of optical components is again becoming quite large. I'd now like to move to another important issue. Question of packet synchronization. If a packet arrives on one line, one input to the packet switch, and is passed through to its appropriate output, and another packet comes perhaps halfway during the time of the first packet and is to be switched to another output, then it's necessary to have a strictly non-blocking switch. Strictly non-blocking means that this input can be rearranged to its appropriate output without interfering with this packet when this packet is passing through. Now, provided you have a strictly non-blocking switch and there are no contention problems, you can handle this kind of situation where the switch is set up for this packet, and when this packet's halfway through, it can be rearranged for the other input without interfering with that packet. But strictly non-blocking switches are large, more complex, and more expensive, and this may not be the most desirable solution. So one way around this would be to synchronize the incoming packets so that the incoming edge of both packets are all lined up at the input of the switch, so the switch can be switched, so this switch can be rearranged once every packet length rather than randomly as the packets arrive. And of course this is a common situation, because if these packets come from different origins through different lengths of optical fibers on different wavelengths, and if the temperature in the fibers is different, you'll never really know when those packets are arriving. So what you might want to do is somehow synchronize the packets to make them line up in time. This could be done by providing a programmable delay on one of those lines or a number of the lines to dynamically change the delay to bring this packet back in line with the other one. And this could be done under some control. And so a component required to do this would be some sort of optical delay which is programmable in a very short period of time. And if you do this, then a rearrangeably non-blocking switch is achievable here, which is much simpler. So how could you go about making a programmable delay? That's another key component. And this is one approach that's been proposed. You could use a course control using a series of lithium niobate, perhaps cross points, with a series of delay lines, and then by appropriately routing the packets through that switch, you could set up the delay under course control. And then fine control to an exact amount of delay could be achieved using a tunable wavelength converter, which converts the wavelength here to a different wavelength at the output, and then passing it through the packet through a high dispersion fiber, or perhaps a dispersive component like a grating, where the propagation time is a function of the wavelength. And so by accurately setting this wavelength, you can determine the time of passage through the fiber. And combined together under an electronic controller, this could give you fine control of the delay and provide packet synchronization. I'd like to say a few words now about the packet routing itself, the space switch that takes packets and routes them to appropriate outputs. And on one of the earlier slides, I showed a demonstration that has been based on the so-called broadcast and select space switch, where incoming packets are converted in wavelength to an appropriate value, then to an appropriate wavelength, passed through some sort of star coupler to set optical filters that then pick the appropriate output. So if this packet has to be switched to this output, then the wavelength converter would convert that packet to the wavelength determined by this filter, and then this filter would select the packet at the appropriate output. This can be done either by making the wavelength converter tunable or the optical filter tunable, but it does require fast tunability. It is possible also by this approach to provide multicasting capability. And this type of conception is compatible with multi-wavelength systems such as WDM and with multi-wavelength buffers. There's another approach that's recently been described, which I think is going to be particularly interesting, using the so-called arrayed waveguide grating multiplexer. And this is a proposal for a photonic ATM switch proposed by some NTT workers based on this arrayed waveguide grating multiplexer. The key characteristic of the arrayed waveguide grating multiplexer, or AWGM, is that it has a number of input lines, a number of output lines, and wavelength channels at each input line are routed to the output line depending upon which line they come to. So if there's a WDM signal at this input line, the C the signal is demultiplexed with each of the signals going to appropriate output lines, whereas a different signal of this input will be demultiplexed differently to different output lines. Hopefully that will become a bit clearer as I explain how the photonic packet switch works. So there are a number of incoming lines to the photonic packet switch, and this shows packets A, D, and G at line 1, packet B, E, and H at line 2. And the first component, again, is a tunable frequency converter, which one packet at a time changes the optical frequency of the packet to some appropriate value. So packet A has been changed by this frequency converter to optical frequency F1. Packet D has been changed to optical frequency F1 also, and packet G has been changed to optical frequency F3. And B, E, and H are at F2, F5, and F2 again. The idea then is that by specifying the optical frequency for each packet, that then predetermines where that packet will pass through the waveguide grating multiplexer. So packet A at frequency F1 is routed through to output 1. And packet D, also at frequency F1, is also routed through to output 1. So there's A and there's D at optical frequency F1. Similarly, packet B, which was also destined for output 1, is now at F2, and that is also routed through here to output 1. And so what you do is you accumulate at this output all the packets that were destined for that output, but at optical frequencies that were required to get them there. So one had to convert packet A to F1 and packet D to F1 to get it to this output, and packet B to F2. And so we now have our packets at the appropriate output, but there's now a possible contention, because in one time slot, packet A and packet B both appear at the same time, although they are, for the time being, not colliding because they're at different optical frequencies. However, for this to be a cascadable system where these packets can then pass on to another system, it's necessary for the packets that come out of the packet switch to all be at one optical frequency. So it's necessary to provide some buffer, and this is a frequency multiplexed output buffer, which then takes these packets, buffers them appropriately so that packet A appears first, packet B second, packet D and packet F. And so inside this buffer here is a loop memory and more optical frequency converters to appropriately rearrange them. Having done all that then, these packet switches can be cascaded. The real challenge in this particular switch is the frequency multiplex output buffer, because that requires buffering and frequency conversion. Well, my time's running out. I'd like to move on now to the question of header replacement, which is an issue which may be important in future photonic packet switching. Header replacement is required in the ATM standard, and essentially what happens is that when a packet passes through a network, a part of the address header needs to be changed as the packet passes through each node. And the part that needs to be changed, or one of the parts that needs to be changed, is called the virtual path identifier. So I've shown here a virtual path identifier which is part of the address header. Entering node 1, it's red to indicate that it has certain content. When it passes through node 1, node 1 actually needs to change that virtual path identifier to something different, and then it's changed again through node 2. And every time it passes through a node, that virtual path identifier needs to change. Now this is fairly straightforward in electronics, but when you think about it, it's not quite so obvious how you would do it in a photonic packet switch, where, remember, each of those packets is meant to be passing through the switch in an all-optical fashion without optical to electrical or electrical to optical conversions. This is an approach to header replacement that we've been working on in our laboratory at the University of Melbourne. And it's a simple method that doesn't require any optical to electrical conversions, or for that matter, it doesn't require any other optical, any new optical sources. There is a single input, this is the incoming packet, and an output, this is the outgoing packet, and the idea is that this little box changes the address header from the input to the output, and it works as follows. There is a splitter that enables the electronic, an optical receiver to look at the address header and drive an electronic controller that controls the whole thing. This input packet is split into two paths by a 3 dB power splitter, and the two paths are as follows. One goes straight through a semiconductor optical amplifier to the output, and the other path goes through a delay and through another semiconductor optical amplifier and is combined again at the output. And both semiconductor optical amplifiers are under the control of the electronic controller. The electronic controller can turn the semiconductor optical amplifiers on or off. And there are two important